The program Can You Top This, usually presented over most of these stations at this time, will not be heard this evening in order that we may bring you a special broadcast. The following period has been purchased by the Democratic National Committee for a political address by the Honorable Franklin D. Roosevelt, Democratic nominee for the office of President of the United States.
Good evening from the Statler Hotel in Washington. The President of the United States in this, his first campaign speech, will be introduced by Mr. Daniel J. Tobin, General President of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters, Chauffeurs, Warehousemen, and Helpers. Mr. Tobin.
Gentlemen, it seems as though an unseen power has always given us able leaders capable of dealing with problems that for a time seem possible, of destroying all the advancements brought over the centuries by men who have given their all so that justice, freedom, and liberty might prevail. There has never been leadership in the last five centuries that has had the problems and the dangers facing civilization such as the world is now confronted with. When the history of this great world struggle is written by unprejudiced men, when the facts are laid bare by those who are not blinded by ambition or the craving for more wealth, then and not until then will this leadership be clearly understood and the dangerous problems which in recent years and now confront the world be made known and fully realized. Tonight we have with us one of those great world leaders whom destiny has educated and trained so that our country might have leadership of courage, experience, and real statesmanship, and that under his guidance and direction, the victories and the freedoms won by the shedding of the blood of the innumerable patriots who have gone before us might be preserved, protected, continued, and improved. Tonight on every battlefield in the world, on the seas and in the air, your sons and his sons are fighting and offering their lives to the end that civilization may continue to advance and the blessings that we enjoy will not be set back, and that we may bring to the suffering peoples of other countries that freedom and that liberty to which they are justly entitled and which we intend shall be theirs. The awful picture of idleness, discouragement, and stagnation confronting our nation in March 1933 is sometimes forgotten by the millions of workers who today are enjoying, even in wartime, the best conditions and earnings ever enjoyed by the toilers at any time in the history of civilization. And in this respect, our country leads all other countries. The membership of organized labor has risen in recent years from 3 million to over 12 million. Regardless of the statements made by the candidates of monopolies and labor haters who have had very little experience, the millions of unorganized workers have also substantially improved and advanced insofar as better hours and better wages are concerned. Let me remind you of the minimum wage and hour law, which brought to the toilers in the mills and factories who had no protection or organization shorter hours and better wages. Lest we forget, do you men of labor remember the closing of the banks of the nation in March 1933, when over 40% of those financial institutions we're on the verge of bankruptcy? Have you forgotten that today, due to the legislation enacted by this progressive leader of our nation, your savings are now protected and that this legislation guarantees that you cannot be cheated and robbed by shady financiers who gambled with a few hard-earned dollars which you entrusted to them, who then is it that ventures to say we must have a change in leadership in order to protect the toilers of this nation? I'll tell you who they are. A band of avaricious manipulators of wealth who would endanger and sacrifice the very liberties that we are fighting for in order to satiate their thirst for power and greater wealth. Look over the aggregation that believe that at this serious time, when we are driving our enemies to surrender and to suicide, who desire to displace the head of our government and substitute one who lacks almost all the qualities and training needed for important, serious world leadership. Every one of them has been opposed to the progress of the toilers. They are the same outfit that has opposed every step forward that we have endeavored to make in the years past to emancipate the workers. Your safety and my safety and the safety and freedom of the country and of the world are now in danger. We must not gamble with the liberties of the human family. Therefore, I impress upon you the greater need to beware of false prophets who come in the clothing of sheep, but who in reality may prove to be dangerous experiments. Keep before your eyes, from now until next November, the 11 million men wearing the uniforms of our country, many of whom have been disfranchised by the opponents of our country's great leader. They are watching you and calmly awaiting your decision as to whether or not you will prove loyal to them. They have been faithful and loyal to you on the battlefields. They are watching you as to whether or not you will support the man who is so gloriously leading them and you on to victory. You and I will have to answer to them and to future generations and prove to them that we are not guilty of the awful crime of ingratitude. I know that the men and women of labor, organized and unorganized, will not prove false to our fighting forces, living or dead. As you have done in the past, you will stand shoulder to shoulder and face to face, supporting that leader of our nation who is daily tortured by willful misrepresentations, that world leader who would gladly give all that he has, even his life, if called upon, so that other men might live in peace and freedom. Gentlemen, I present to you the President of the United States.
Mr. Tobin, I should say Dan. I always have. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm very much touched. And I'm very happy in your applause, and very happy at the informality of this dinner with old friends of mine. Not the first time that we have met together on this basis. And I am particularly happy that this national campaign opens in your presence, as it did 4 years ago. And I don't mind mentioning the fact that Dan Tobin and I are just a little bit superstitious. Well, here we are. Here we are again after 4 years, and what years they have been. You know, I am actually 4 years older, which is a fact that seems to annoy some people. In fact, in the mathematical field, there are millions of Americans who are more than 11 years older than when we started in to clear up the mess that was dumped into our laps in 1933. We all know that certain people who make it a practice to depreciate the accomplishments of labor, who even attack labor as unpatriotic, they keep this business up, usually for 3 years and 6 months in a row. But then, for some strange reason, they change their tune every 4 years, just before election day. When votes are at stake, they suddenly discover that they really love labor. And that they are anxious to protect labor from its old friends. I got quite a laugh, for example, and I'm sure that you did, when I read this plank in the Republican platform adopted at their national convention last July. The Republican Party accepts the purposes of the National Labor Relations Act, the Wage and Hour Act, the Social Security Act, and all other federal statutes designed to promote and protect the welfare of American working men and women, and we promise a fair and just administration of those laws. You know, many of the Republican leaders and congressmen and candidates who shouted enthusiastic approval of that plank in that convention hall would not even recognize these progressive laws if they met them in broad daylight. Indeed, they have personally spent years of effort and energy and much money in fighting every one of those laws in the Congress and in the press and in the courts ever since this administration began to advocate them and enact them into legislation. This is a fair example of their insincerity and of their inconsistency. The whole purpose of Republican oratory these days seems to be to switch labels. The object is to persuade the American people that the Democratic Party was responsible for the 1929 crash and the Depression, and that the Republican Party was responsible for all social progress under the New Deal. Now, imitation may be the sincerest form of flattery, but I am afraid that in this case it is the most obvious common or garden variety of fraud. Of course, it's perfectly true that there are enlightened liberal elements in the Republican Party, and they have fought hard and honorably to bring the party up to date and to get it in step with the forward march of American progress. But these liberal elements were not able to drive the old guard Republicans from their entrenched position. Can the old guard pass itself off as the New Deal? I think not. We have seen many marvelous stunts in the circus, but no performing elephant could turn a handspring without falling flat on its back. I need not recount to you the centuries of history that have been crowded into these 4 years since I saw you last. There were some in the Congress and out who raised their voices against our preparations for defense before and after 1939. Objected to them, raised their voices against them as hysterical warmongering, who cried out against our help to the Allies as provocative and dangerous. We remember those voices. They would like to have us forget them now. But in 1940 and 1949, my, it seems a long time ago, they were loud voices. Happily, they were in a minority. And fortunately for ourselves and for the world, they could not stop America. There are some politicians who kept their heads buried in the sand while the storms of Europe and Asia were headed our way, who said that the Land Lease Bill would bring an end, and I'm quoting, to free government in the United States, and who said, and I'm quoting, only hysteria entertains the idea that Germany, Italy, or Japan contemplate war on us. These very men, are now asking the American people to entrust to them the conduct of our foreign policy and our military policy. What the Republican leaders are now saying, in effect, is this: oh, just forget what we used to say. We've changed our minds now. We've been reading the public opinion polls about these things. And now we know what the American people want. And they say, don't leave the task of making the peace to those old men who first urged it and who have laid already the foundations for it and who have had to fight all of us inch by inch during the last 5 years to do it. Why, just turn it all over to us. We'll do it so skillfully that we won't lose a single isolationist vote or a single isolationist campaign contribution. I think there's one thing that you know. I am too old for that. I cannot talk out of both sides of my mouth at the same time. The government of the United States welcomes all sincere supporters of the cause of effective world collaboration in the making of a lasting peace. Millions of Republicans all over the nation are with us and have been with us in our unshakable determination to build the solid structure of peace. And they too will resent this campaign talk by those who first woke up to the facts of international life a few short months ago. When they began to study the polls of public opinion. Those who today have the military responsibility for waging this war in all parts of the globe are not helped by the statements of men who, without responsibility and without the knowledge of the facts, lecture the chiefs of staff of the United States as to the best means of dividing our armed forces and our military resources between the Atlantic and the Pacific, between the Army and the Navy, and among the commanding generals of the different theaters of war. And I may say that those commanding generals are making good in a big way. When I addressed you 4 years ago, I said this. I said, I know that America will never be disappointed in its expectation that labor will always continue to do its share of the job we now face, and do it patriotically and effectively and unselfishly. Today, we know that America has not been disappointed. In his order of the day when the Allied armies first landed in Normandy 2 months ago, General Eisenhower said, our home fronts have given us overwhelming superiority in weapons and munitions of war. The country knows that there's a breed of cats, luckily not too numerous, labor betas. I know that those labor betas among the opposition who are there, but who, instead of calling attention to the achievements of labor in this war, prefer to pick on the occasional strikes that have occurred, strikes that have been condemned by every responsible national labor leader. Parenthetically, all but one. And that one labor leader, incidentally, is not conspicuous among my supporters. Labor betas forget that at our peak, American labor and management have turned out airplanes at the rate of 109,000 a year. Tanks, 57,000 a year. Combat vessels, 573 a year. Landing vessels to get the troops ashore, 51,000 a year. Cargo ships, 19 million tons a year. Henry Kaiser's here tonight, I'm glad to say. And small arms ammunition? Oh, I can't understand it. Don't believe you can either. 23 billion rounds a year. But a strike is news. and generally appears in shrieking headlines. And of course, they say labor is always to blame. The fact is that since Pearl Harbor, only 0.1% of man hours have been lost by strikes. Can you beat that? Candidates who burst out in election year affection for social legislation and for labor in general, still think that you ought to be good boys and stay out of politics. And above all, they hate to see any working man or woman contribute a dollar bill to any wicked political party. Of course, it's all right for large financiers and industrialists and monopolists to contribute tens of thousands of dollars. But their solicitude for that dollar which the men and women in the ranks of labor contribute is always very touching. They are, of course, perfectly willing to let you vote unless you happen to be a soldier or a sailor overseas or a merchant seaman carrying the munitions of war. In that case, they've made it pretty hard for you to vote at all. For there are some political candidates who think that they may have a chance of election if only the total vote is small enough. And while I'm on the subject of voting, let me urge every American citizen, man and woman, to use your sacred privilege of voting, no matter which candidate you expect to support. Our millions of soldiers and sailors and merchant seamen have been handicapped or prevented from voting by those politicians, and those candidates who think that they stand to lose by such votes. You here at home have the freedom of the ballot, irrespective of party. You should register and vote this November. I think that is a matter of plain good citizenship. Words come easily, but they do not change the record. You are, most of you, old enough to remember what things were like for labor in 1932. You remember the closed banks and the bread lines and the starvation wages, the foreclosures of homes and farms, and the bankruptcies of business, the Hooverville, and the young men and women of the nation facing a hopeless, jobless future. The closed factories and mines and mills, the ruined and abandoned farms, the stalled railroads, the empty docks, the blank despair of a whole nation, and the utter impotence of the federal government. You remember the long, hard road with its gains and its setbacks, which we have traveled together ever since those days. Now, there are some politicians, of course, who do not remember that far back. And there are some who remember, but find it convenient to forget. No, the record is not to be washed away that easily. The opposition in this year has already imported into this campaign a very interesting thing because it's foreign. They have imported the propaganda technique invented by the dictators abroad. Remember, a number of years ago, there was a book, Mein Kampf, written by Hitler himself. The technique was all set out in Hitler's book, and it was copied by the aggressors of Italy and Japan. According to that technique, you should never use a small falsehood. Always a big one, for its very fantastic nature would make it more credible. If only you keep repeating it over and over and over again. Let's take some simple illustrations that come to mind. For example, although I rubbed my eyes when I read it, we have been told that it was not a Republican depression, but a Democratic depression from which this nation was saved in 1933. That this administration, this one, today, is responsible for all the suffering and misery that the history books and the American people have always thought had been brought about during the 12 ill-fated years when the Republican Party was in power. Now, there's an old and somewhat lugubrious adage which says, never speak of a rope in the house of a man who's been hanged. In the same way, if I were a Republican leader speaking to a mixed audience, the last word in the whole dictionary that I would think of using is that word, depression. Pop up all the time. For another example, I learned much to my amazement that the policy of this administration was to keep men in the army when the war is over because there might be no jobs for them in civil life. Well, the very day that this fantastic charge was first made, a formal plan for the method of speedy discharge from the army had already been announced by the War Department, a plan based on the wishes of the soldiers themselves. This callous and brazen falsehood about demobilization was, of course, a very simple thing. It was an effort to stimulate fear among American mothers and wives and sweethearts. And incidentally, it was hardly calculated to boast the morale of our soldiers and sailors and airmen who are fighting our battles all over the world. But perhaps the most ridiculous of these campaign falsifications is the one that this administration failed to prepare for the war that was coming. I doubt whether even Goebbels would have tried that one. Even he would never have dared hope that the voters of America had already forgotten that many of the Republican leaders in the Congress and outside the Congress tried to thwart and block nearly every attempt that this administration made to warn our people and arm our nation.
Some of them called our 50,000 airplane program fantastic. Many of those very same leaders who fought every defense measure that we proposed are still in control of the Republican Party. Look at the name. Were in control of its national convention in Chicago and would be in control of the machinery of the Congress and of the Republican Party in the event of a Republican victory this fall. These Republican leaders have not been content with attacks on me, or on my wife, or on my son. No, not content with that. They now include my little dog, Fowler. Don't resent attacks. And my family don't resent attacks. But Fala does resent attacks. You know, Fala's Scotch. And being a Scotty, as soon as he learned that the Republican fiction writers in Congress and out had concocted a story that I'd left him behind on an Aleutian island and had sent a destroyer back to find him at a cost to the taxpayers of $2 or $3 or $8 or $20 million, his Scotch soul was furious. Not been the same dog since. I am accustomed to hearing malicious falsehoods about myself, such as that old worm-eaten chestnut that I have represented myself as indispensable. But I think I have a right to resent, to object to libelous statements about my dog. I think we all recognize the old technique. The people of this country know the past too well to be deceived into forgetting. Too much is at stake to forget. There are tasks ahead of us which we must now complete with the same will, the same skill and intelligence and devotion that have already led us so far along the road to victory. There is no task of finishing victoriously this most terrible of all wars as speedily as possible and with the least cost in lives. There is the task of setting up international machinery to assure that peace once established will not again be broken. And there is the task that we face here at home, the task of reconverting our economy for the purposes of war, from the purposes of war to the purposes of peace. These peace-building tasks were faced once before, nearly a generation ago. They were botched, B-O-T-C-H-E-D. They were botched by a Republican administration. That must not happen this time. We will not let it happen this time. Unfortunately, we do not begin from scratch. Much has been done. Much more is underway. The fruits of victory this time will not be apples sold on street corners. Many months ago, the administration set up necessary machinery for an orderly peacetime demobilization. The Congress has passed much more legislation, continuing the agencies needed for demobilization, with additional powers to carry out their function. I know that the American people, business and labor and agriculture, have the same will, basic will, to do for peace what they have done for war. And I know that they can sustain a national income that will assure full production and full employment under our democratic system of private enterprise, with government encouragement and aid whenever and wherever that is necessary. The keynote, back of all this literature that we read, the keynote of all that we propose to do in reconversion can be found in the one word, jobs. We shall lease or dispose of our government-owned plants and facilities and our surplus war property and land on the basis of how they can be best operated by private enterprise to give jobs to the greatest number. We shall follow a wage policy that will sustain the purchasing power of labor. Well, that means more production and more jobs. You and I know that the present policies on wages and prices were conceived to serve the needs of the great masses of the people. They stopped inflation. They kept prices on a relatively stable level. Through the demobilization period, policies will be carried out with the same objective in mind, to serve the needs of the great masses of the people. This is not the time in which men can be forgotten, as they were in the Republican catastrophe that we inherited. The returning soldiers, the workers by their machines, the farmers in the field, the miners, the men and women in offices and shops, do not intend to be forgotten. No, they know that they are not surplus, because they know that they are American. We must set targets and objectives for the future which will seem impossible, like the aeroplane, to those who live in and are weighted down by the dead past. And for months and today and in the future, we are organizing and will continue to put forth the logistics of the peace, just as Marshall and King and Arnold, MacArthur, Eisenhower, and Nimitz are organizing the logistics of this war. I think that the victory of the American people and their allies in this war will be far more than a victory
against fascism and reaction and the dead hand of despotism of the past. The victory of the American people and their allies in this war will be a victory for democracy. It will constitute such an affirmation of the strength and power and vitality of government by the people as history has never before witnessed. And so, my friends, with that affirmation of the vitality of democratic government behind us, that demonstration of its resilience and its capacity for decision and for action, with that knowledge of our own strength and power, we move forward with God's help to the greatest epoch of free achievement by free man that the world has ever known.
Gentlemen, you have heard the President of the United States. He was introduced by Mr. Daniel J. Tobin and spoke from the Statler Hotel in Washington.